This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Well, I guess this is going to be a lot of fun because when I was doing the service in there, that statue of the Buddha over there kept smiling at me. You know, I can't explain it. I mean, it's like I look at you and you smile and I smile. And, you know, the feeling flows between us, and it's just fabulous to have that happen. You know, no boundaries at all. Well, since this is the Science and Buddhism Day, and Cliff asked me if I would speak as an ecologist on ecology, I thought it might be good to direct it by giving it a title. I thought the title of this could be The Life of an Ecologist Who Encountered Holy Silence. Ecology is the science of the relationships and connections between everything. So we're all connected. So my life and your life are not separate from ecology. Thank you. Yep. Okay. Well, it's always fun to start out thinking about a Dharma talk. You know, you're going to do something like this, and you know, like there's this wonderful series of talks. It's 100,000 pages on microfilm in Stanford Library, and in 1920, it was thought that the Indian language of this whole Central California area was extinct, and then a native speaker of the language, who was a wonderful, her name is Ascensión Solórzano, and she lived in San Juan. And she said, "I will teach my language to somebody." And at that time, J.P. Harrington was the chief ethnologist at the Smithsonian, and he came out and lived with her for 3 years, and essentially saved her language. You know, extensive vocabulary, and extensive story, Indian stories about the things. And one of them that I got to thinking about this week is that. There is in Uvas Creek, not far from here, there is a story of a giant serpent who lived in a cave and had been there for generations of human beings, and they revered this giant snake. It was a rattlesnake, I think. And then I was just thinking about this big snake and how cool it must have been to see a giant rattlesnake. You know, I've always been fascinated by rattlesnakes, and you know, I catch lots of them, and you know, the biggest one that I've seen around here is about 6 feet long in Central California. But then I got to think about, you know, I take care of this big gorilla on Tuesdays and Thursdays in the morning. His name is Ndumi, and I like to play jokes on him. So the first thing that I did that went to this, if I can ever get this bucket open. I went over to Ndumi. I was out hiking in the woods, and I found this snake horn. And I thought, you know, people don't usually think of snakes as having horns, but, you know, like, you know, this gorilla who likes me to bring live snakes to him, and he looks at them, and he always says, "Thank you," when I show him a snake. So I thought, well, this is a start, a good snake horn. So would you like a snake horn?
I would.
I've never held one before. Well, it probably can wear it with your turtle fur boots.
Probably could.
So, the last few days, I've been crying a lot. I've been missing my wife, and I've been missing Coben. And on Wednesdays, you know, I keep 24-hour silence and go off to a big ranch, 3 hours drive from here. And so on Wednesday, I went over there, and I unlocked the gate, and I drove in as I was driving in, and here comes one of the ranch hands, you know, on his horse riding over, and I said, I brought a pie for Charlie and Jimmy, my friends. When I go visit them, I often bring them a pie. So I got this pie. And then Carlos, this ranch hand, he said, oh, Charlie just passed away. And I guess it just has made me feel so, you know, the Buddha very often says, you know, like, death comes unexpectedly. How can we bargain with it? So in other words, he's encouraging us to practice today, to do our best today, to really actualize, you know, whatever it is that is speaking to us that brings us here to the Zendo. I don't know what it is. Do we know what it is? We don't know. Something brings us here. So it just made me feel like that I am, I mean, it spurred me on a little bit. And then I thought I should say something about death. So this is the skull of a large wild boar. And you can, you know, I'll pass it around, and you can see that, you know, the size of these tusks. And one of my favorite pastimes is that I've learned how to recognize where the big wild boar sleep. And when I'm by myself out in the woods, I'm moving in silence. And so I am able to sneak up on these boar, and I get right close to them. And then, you know, my other gorilla friend Coco taught me how to do this, to do that sound, and she would call to me when I'm cooking in the kitchen, and she would, you know, with that call, and I would immediately answer it, and then we would purr to each other very, ooh, and then I would know that it's time to go have a visit with Coco, and but now she's gone too, and so it just seems like, you know, there's something going on here, talking to me. Nico, could you untie that for me?
Mm-hmm. Or just at me or
no, it's tame.
It's tame. That's good to know.
Might be a new definition of tame.
Oh, did you get it open? Cut it open if you want. Thank you, Lisa. Here, I'll just rip it open. As a professional ecologist, somebody who has to be able to find animals and plants that are listed as rare and endangered, so that I can get federal money to buy and protect land, like all the land around Jokoji is protected now by open space because, you know, I found San Francisco garter snakes and red-legged frogs here many years ago, and so it enabled the open space district to buy all this land, which now protects Jokoji. So one of the ways that you have to be able to understand about how to find animals and plants. And one of the best ways is to find roadkills. And, you know, frequently around here, I pick up roadkills and you may think I'm weak, but it's just this bag is strong. How can we pass this around? Pass it around. I was gonna put it off, but I have all of my 100 drinks here. So, you know, this raccoon is clean. It's a healthy young adult. You know, if I were hungry, I would cook it. They make very good stew. So let's pass this. I guess we don't really need a bag, do we? Because there's no blood. But, you know, it's just, you know, here's our neighbor, you know, it's just, you know, you can just, you know, you can pet him and, you know, and feel what the fur of a raccoon is like.
How long since it was deceased?
It was just hit this morning. Or last night. So thinking about my friend Coben, who started up this temple here, and ecology, he once suggested that I study people in terms of their unique ecological system. So each one of us is connected to everything else, and the way that you study people, and according to what Coben told me about this as an ecologist, you know, we're studying the connections. You know, what are the connections? We have the air. We have, but it's kind of deeper. And I think the word ecology is, you know, about connectedness of all things, the study of the connectedness of all things. But also, you know, this today is a Dharma talk, and what is Dharma? Dharma means something like that which unites everything, where there's boundarylessness. You know, we're all completely connected with everything else. That's the Dharma. And he also gave me, Coben also gave me a clue in studying ecology. He said the way to understand ecology is to investigate this particular koan. Koan is something that is a communication that goes between, you know, Zen teachers and other Zen teachers or other students of Zen. And the koan that he suggested that I study is, and that you might also, he said, Bodhidharma, who's the first Zen ancestor in China, he and the oak tree are not separate. Well, how do you understand that you know, here's an oak tree right here out the window, and here's a nice big oak tree. You know, and so we put ourselves, I think the way Coben wanted me to understand this is to be Bodhidharma. You know, so I am Bodhidharma and I am the oak tree. We are not separate. So the solution of this, the under way to understand this koan is it's me. I think that's the way that we take ecology here. So, and here's another thing at the Nehane Sesshin, which we just finished here, a week-long retreat. Coben said, holy silence is the space where your psyche can be totally free without hindrance of any kind. It is like clean air with no dust. Mind is captured by matter, but when matter is not there, the mind recovers its nature, which is time and space itself. Coben was an interesting dude. He showed us all how to unite all religions through this practice. All the religions have their, you know, like Christianity. I was raised as a Christian Scientist, and you know, and Coben encouraged me very much to continue my study of that. And he said that Christian Science prayer is exactly Zazen. You know, so in the world where everything is so crazy and everything seems so separate, you know, I think it's very nice to have someone like him who can bring us this, you know, how do we unite with everybody? You know, he talked to me about, he and I like to drink together sake sometimes, and he would say that sake is the least powerful intoxicant, I guess is what we should look at it. But religious zealotry is maybe the most powerful, and so our precept of no using intoxicants, I think, refers more to that kind, to that, you know, not being intoxicated by ideas and things. So this whole my connection with what I'm have written and I'm reading here is that on Wednesday I went off by myself to work on this talk, and I went into a deep place, and light just poured out of my eyes, and tears just poured out of my eyes all day long. And finally I said to myself, you know, Don't give a talk about Dharma. Don't give a talk about ecology. Don't give a talk about something which is separate from your life. You know, open your heart. Come on, just let it come out. You know, let it, you know, and then maybe you can be of some help to people. You know, I look at my teachers, and I see how much help they have given me. And in my life, I've just had so much love and so much help. And, you know, I never would have made it by myself, on my own. So I prayed to God, and I said, whatever you want to call it, the ultimate dimension of the universe, or by whatever name you want to call it. Sometimes when I was scared, I used to call upon this thing which can be called upon. And I gave it the name of Silas, because I was when I was a boy, I was often teased by being called Nature Boy, you know, by the tough guys in the neighborhood, you know. So I didn't like that. So I called upon God, and I gave him the name Silas. And Silas was somebody that I'd read about in a book, who was a real tough guy, you know. And so, you know, when they would tease me on the bus coming home from school, and then I would say to myself, Silas. And then I would just listen. And it would kind of, you know, and calling upon this, you know, is something that has been very powerful for me. So I called upon this spirit, this great spirit. And the great spirit pointed me to a notebook of my morning Dharma study from about 4 years ago when my wife was still alive. And I thought it might be a fun thing to try and read. You know, this is something like opening my heart. You know, this is about my wife and myself taking on a particular trip. You'll see it unfolds. I think you can sense what I am trying to get at by intuitively. The pair of them vanish into the ocean of fog like wisps. It's nice. Signs of urbanization and agriculture and electric lights of all kinds give way to the occasional porch light of an unseen ranch house all by itself in a landscape of darkness, and finally to nothing. They have the road all to themselves, burrowing on and on into the night. There are stars, but then there are no stars. Not good. Where they expected to see lots of wildflowers, there are none. At first, it's only little wafts of fog in the low places floating through the high beams. But then, the deeper they get into the higher Panza range, the more solid the fog gets. Since they are not strawberries or lettuces, they do not, as a couple, fare well in a fog of any kind. You know what I mean. You know, a mental fog between people is not a good place for a couple to be in. You know, you want things to be clear and freely divulged. So we are now moving along so slowly in our truck. I am now paying such close attention to the road at our feet that an image of our truck with us in it emerges. It is the image of a large ant on a cold night with spindly legs moving as slowly as our wheels. The totally robotic, bulging, and immobile eyes. Have you ever looked into the eyes of an ant? You know, look up close in the eyes of an ant. Get a lens or something and look into the eyes of an ant, and you will see. It's almost alarming, you know. Like once I wrote legal papers, and one of the people that I wrote a legal paper for was a killer, and his eyes were like the eyes of an ant. They were stone cold. You know, nobody here has anything like that. I mean, you don't meet a stone cold killer in the Zendo. At least I haven't yet. So anyway, here's this ant with these robotic eyes, and it was such a the image in my head was just so like cartoonish, you know? But this night, I was, the memory hardly evoked a smile at all. The world revealed by my headlights continues to narrow. The curves in the road continue to sharpen, and the roadside brush continues to crowd in closer. In the headlights just ahead, the fog is a wall of bright white light. The cab of the truck gets smaller and smaller. Thought by unspoken thought, a sense of anxiety builds. My gut tightens. Euphemisms like, "It'll get better," are just too hollow. When the future craps on the present with thoughts like, "Are we going to be stuck in this fog forever?" Something has to be done. So I pull over at the foot, the first widest place in a tunnel of fog, and stop. There's a pine tree, a nice pine tree. My wife Tina and I look at each other. I take a stab at it. You know, sometimes when you're in as a couple, you have the morass of disturbing emotions when you're all, when you're caught in the midst of them, is so hard to break open. It doesn't want to get broken open and spoken about, because then it's gone. So we're getting separated and isolated by this disturbing anxiety that we're never going to get out of this fog. So we talked about it and we connected, and then we decided to keep on trucking, but maybe not think of getting all the way down to the Mojave Desert, which is where we were originally planning on going, but maybe only go as far as the Carrizo Plains. Do you know the Carrizo Plains? It is a vast open space, 350,000 acres. And if you really want to be alone and you really want to experience what holy silence is, this is a very good place to go. It's a long drive, but you get there by driving through the night and through a tunnel of fog, and all the ranches are coming around trying to grab at your truck, but you have four-wheel drive. So I'm back in gear again. The driver soon catches occasional glimpses of pale bluish sky through the fog, like glimmers of hope, as we crest the ridges, dividing watersheds. Still, we feel like we're in a canoe, like Alexander Mackenzie. Do you know Alexander Mackenzie? Do you know about him? He was the first European to go down and explore the river now named after him, called the Mackenzie River, and it's the Mississippi of the Arctic. It's like, when I was standing at the mouth of the Mackenzie River when I was on a biological collecting expedition when I was a young man, it's like a mile across. I mean, it's like, it's an enormous river. I mean, it's a mile wide. But anyway, this Alexander Mackenzie, he was going, and this is our Zazen, you know, our Zazen is kind of like a canoe, you know. We are going down this unknown river. There are waterfalls, there are hostile natives in their villages on the banks of the river. You know, there are rapids, you know, and all of your supplies are wrapped in hide, and they're in your canoe with you. And if you tip over the canoe, or if you go over a big falls, which you don't even know what's ahead, you know, not good. So anyway, he proceeded, like we proceed in our Zazen practice, you know, not knowing what's ahead, not knowing what we're going to get into. You know, it's not all sweet. But after what seems like a very long time, the chute of this tunnel that we're going through spits us out into the gentle mystery of openness and spaciousness that is the Carrizo Plains. We can breathe at last. At first, the truck rolls along as if it had no driver, on its own momentum, transporting two dazed nomads. That's me and my wife. But then we are looking at each other and laughing. You have to say it. And we say it at the same time. We're unstoppable. You know, as a couple, you know, when you can unite in a crisis like that and make a connection, even though everything seems like it's falling apart, you know, you can be unstoppable. So it's starting to be daylight now, and I see this a lone prairie falcon. It was making lazy circles in the sky. You know, and you see this bird, you know, this is, we're talking about here the fastest bird on Earth. You know, like, I was in a small plane flying down to Santa Cruz Island from where I lived on Santa Cruz Island on a biological station there. And as I would. So I'd have to go out on Navy boats, or I'd have to fly in a small airplane. But one time we were going along, and the airspeed indicator on this little Cessna said 220 miles an hour. That's pretty fast, you know? And then suddenly, whammo, this prairie falcon goes past us like we're standing still. I mean, it's like, wow, my eyes got as big as dinner plates. So anyway, beware all you sleepy curlews on the ground. This falcon is here. Color precedes the sun. We angle off the road and curve up and around a low hill. Even this early in the day, the big 3,000 acres of Salt Lake shimmers like it holds water, but it doesn't. We're smiling and chatting as we remember another time when the shallow waters of the lake simmered with tiny shrimp. I was disappointed one time. I was doing an ecological project in the Colorado Rockies above Timberline, and I found this glacial pool, crystal clear ice water, and in it it was just simmering with these tiny fairy shrimp. And I thought, oh, I found a new species of shrimp. But then when I got back to the lab and looked it up, it turned out that somebody 2 years before had found that same species of shrimp and named it. Not for me either. So we ease to a stop. Right away, Tina opens her door. Maybe even before her foot touches the ground, she changes. I can feel it. Real quiet is a visceral thing, she says quietly. I like the quiet, but it's the stone dead quiet, the reverence in her voice that I hear. The quiet one has come forth. Carrizo Plains, you know, that was inhabited by two groups of Indians, the Yokuts Indians and the Chumash Indians. And they both had a shared word for the quiet one, or the beautiful one. It's called Cholame. And I suppose that would be a nice alternative word to use for, you know, the divine presence than God, wouldn't it? Yeah. Cholame, the quiet one, the beautiful one. So Tina says, sometimes you have to drive so far to get to this quiet, pure quiet, no sound whatsoever. To me, even thoughts make sound. So when I sit and when I'm in these quiet, remote places that I like to go to, there are no thoughts. It's just pure mind before thinking. So I myself am just standing. I haven't even taken one step. My body is still unvibrating after the long night drive. And then I walk around the truck and I stand beside her. In a quick second, this is kind of an intimate thing. Maybe I shouldn't read it, but this is who I am. In a quick second, she has seized me by the waist. With her two arms, she is squeezing me with all she's got. Her strength is more than that of one woman. It's more like the strength of all women combined. It's amazing. Then suddenly she lets go and we're just there on the ground. Then I notice that she is peeking. She was up to my shoulder. She was not a tall woman. But I notice that she is peeking up over my shoulder at me. And in her eyes is a look of felonious mischief. So I don't know what's going to happen next. But her eyes are shining with happiness. It's not just a visual thing. Other senses are alive. I sense something like expectancy from her. It's kind of like a kitten, you know, a playful kitten that's completely attuned to the perfect moment to attack and bother me to smithereens. She's Hobomoke. Do you know who Hobomoke is? Hobomoke was the war chief of some Indians who lived in what is now the Carolinas. And his tactic was that when the first European invaders were coming there, he would attack suddenly and with complete force and then vanish. So he'd swoop in, hit him, and then he's gone. They couldn't find him, and it was just so mysterious for a long time that even, you know, the first lepidopterist, the first person who studied butterflies and moths, who was in the Carolinas, there's a small orange skipper butterfly. It kind of has triangular wings. It sits with its wings always put together like this. But if you're walking along through its territory, it'll fly out right up to you like that, and then it'll zoom away just like that. You know, and so this early lepidopterist, he named the butterfly Powani's Hobomok after this Indian war chief who had that same kind of a tactic. So I feel her body pressing up against my side, ready. She's warm and yielding, nice and content, but it's way more than words. As so I'm standing, utterly helpless. I haven't the faintest idea what's coming, but before anything at all can happen, she's pushing against me so exuberantly that I have to shift my feet and brace myself or she'll topple me over. How unadult. How wonderful. How fun. This is our little game. We're a happy older couple in their element. It's a moment. Little do we know that in just 5 months she will suddenly and unexpectedly die, and everything will fall into unreliability. She says, there's so much space. She says, women love space. They need space, and not just physical space either. I'm hanging on her every word. She continues, and no one's here. And the planes are federal land, so they belong to everyone. I'm everyone, so it's mine. Hear how pleased she sounds. A big hawk, not a red tail, but definitely a beauty-o, and one of the soaring hawks like the red tails that we have here, glides away from an old fence post where it spent not only the night, but has awakened in the day in its own sweet time. No alarm clock or anything. And I think to myself, that's really cool. It's cool that that 4x4 top of a fence post, you know, that's not very big, was bed enough for someone like this hawk on this vast plains all by itself. We lift our faces and bask in the warmth of the sun. She walks off a few steps just as she likes, no hurry at all. I describe her posture as listening or curious, like a young owl. Her head is cocked slightly to one side, like she's listening to something on the other side of the truck, but not really knowing what it is. See, she's hearing something. You know, you have that sense that sometimes when you spend a lot of time alone in the woods, you know, not particularly thinking about anything or not talking about anything, or, you know, you could do it by yourself or you could do it with another person too, if you have that kind of a person. So I invite her to walk up to the top of the hill with me and take a look at the lake. She refuses. You go. I want to go with you. You go. So after a pause, I trot up to the hilltop in thongs, have a look at the lake, the bigness of the plains and the distant mountains, breathe, and trot back down. When I get back down to her, she's laughing and laughing and laughing, and it's contagious. I say, what? And she says, you look funny. I've never seen you move like that. And I explain that this particular gait is one that I have discovered that allows me to travel great distances, you know, 10 or 20 miles in an afternoon or a day in the wilderness. It's almost effortless. Moving in this kind of a way. It's very free. It's kind of like flowing. And she said, you never told me you jog. We've been married more than 40 years. She's still learning about me. I say, I don't jog. This gait has nothing to do with getting exercise. It's simply a natural way of traveling when I'm alone, when no one can see me. She says, there's no traffic. There's no sound at all. The more deeply I listen, the more extraordinary it is. There isn't even air sound. Come to think of it, one never experiences complete quiet in town or even in most parks or walks of life. The quiet when not a thought arises in the mind. It's all too easy to forget that such a state of mind exists. If you don't, that's why this is why we sit every day. This is why sometimes we might take a vow to sit at least 1 minute every day for the rest of our lives. You know, we're connecting with this place, this state of mind, where not a thought arises. Speaking from her own space, Tina thinks out loud, appreciatively. Well, she says, I got back to the desert after all. Her voice tells how amazed she is. She says, I really tried to get us back into retreat, but it's like everything was holding us off. It wasn't my fault. She says, it's kind of fun to have the plains all to ourselves. And since we've been here, I haven't seen a single billboard of rules. Have you? No. So, we can do whatever we want. No one's supervising us. No one's fucking with every step we take. I'm quoting my wife here. That's Coben's way. He didn't fuck with us. You know, he didn't tell us what to do. He didn't tell us where to go or what we had to do. He didn't have a lot of rules. But he was very kind, and he was always right there with us. And when you had the worst problem, and you were just going through hell in your sitting. You know, in the early years of my sitting, I would sit there and I would just shake, and I couldn't control it. You know, and I worked with Coben on many different, you know, he told me many different things about, you know, I don't shake very much anymore. It's just I don't. But Coben, you know, he let us all find our own way. He didn't say you have to do this. He didn't give us a lot of rules. But then when we found the great way, when we found Buddha's way, what we found is our own heart way. And you can trust in your heart. So now we're back in the comfortable cab of our soft silver truck rolling along the main dirt road again. I spot a burrowing owl perched on a fence post without a fence way up ahead. We ease to a stop alongside it, enjoy some eye-to-eye contact with this little owl. It has such nice brown eyes, and then it flies. Its flight pattern is as distinctive as everything else about Spio Taito cunicularia, the burrowing owl. It flaps its short wings and glides alternately, but only for a short ways. It makes a perfect landing on a low mound of earth dug up by a ground squirrel. It stands up straight like some kind of a micro-human, all legs and slim body, neither neck nor arms. And then we mosey along. We see our fifth and sixth coyotes of the hour. She says, it's nice to see coyotes in their own space, acting natural, wary and alert, but not jumpy, like us. She says, you can see far. It's kind of a meditative observation that she's made. It's a little different from a quantifiable fact. After some time passes, she says, it's quiet out here, way out here. Way out here in a place like the Carrizo Plains, the quiet almost becomes visible. You can sense it. It is so pure. I reply wholeheartedly, condensing volumes into one word. Yep. She's my whole world. Oh, Jesus, this is hard. She says, this is desert. She hadn't thought of the Carrizo Plains as desert until just now. But after we tried, we lived quiet and remote. No electricity, no phone, no running water in the Mojave for the last 5 years. She knows what desert is. It's not a wasteland, awful and dead, or a place without neighbors. She says, we don't have to drive all the way to the Mojave to get what I love. It's a revelation. We are riding along slow and easy, not trying to get somewhere. We're here. In the rearview mirror, I can see for miles and miles, and there's no vehicular dust, just ours. There are tumbleweeds. She likes tumbleweeds. Especially the fresh-looking ones. Some are enormous, kind of lenticular. Others are quite petite. We share a laugh about tumbleweeds taking over Tumbleweed Street. She says, I want one to hang from the ceiling, like a piñata. She says, I want to have cheery Christmas tree lights on it. Her light is lighting up. Beside the road, little San Joaquin antelope squirrels are going about their business. There are both adults and young of the year, two distinct sizes. For quite a while, I am wondering what it is about the behavior of the ones I am seeing here that's different from the other places I see them. Finally, I realize what it is. This place has a fair bit of vegetation, still small and xeric, desert-like, but it's not like a desert grazed by cattle. There is a sense of the well-being of the ecosystem and the antelope squirrels. It's not desperation. It's interesting to see and identify it. Also, in the habitat I usually see the antelope ground squirrels, they are in competition with the larger California ground squirrels. There are no California ground squirrels down in the desert. Also, these antelope ground squirrels seldom see vehicles or humans. How relaxed they look. You know, it's interesting to be able to spend time alone. I hope that when you're here at Jikoji that you'll take a little time to go off in the woods and just be in the woods by yourself. And you know, this is a really special place for that. You know, you can do that safely here. There is something I love about living an ecologically savvy life. I have a crystal clear sense of how rare and how unique as a species the San Joaquin antelope squirrel is. I am painfully aware that in a flash the species can be no more. This morning I have seen more of this rare and endangered species than I have seen in my life until that time. It's very sad that the public does not know that the preserve pretty much saves an entire species from extinction. I imagine people might be thinking, why is one species valuable? The answer lies in experiencing. How does it feel to see the little ones run and eat and kiss? How does it feel? To experience the revelation, the connection of the heart, the holy silence of nature. It's here, you know. You know, this, the holy science is here. It's wherever we go. It's not an outside thing. It's something. It's in your heart. To the sunrise side, a pair of parallel ruts move off across the dead flat of a dry lake, traverse the San Andreas Rift Zone, snake up the bare slopes of the Temblor Range, and finally disappear at the crest. With the touch of my hand, like a miracle, the four-wheel drive of this high-clearance truck engages. Off we go. A steady parade of horned larks, fast lizards, and tiny beetles move aside. It's still too early for Lepidoptera, butterflies, and moths. Tina says, this is a nice season to be here for those who love quiet and solitude more than wildflowers. And it's not hot. She says, is this preserve really open 24 hours? Yep. So we can be here on hot summer nights in our air-conditioned cab when all the desert endemics you like are on the road, like shovel-nosed snakes. Ha, ha, ha. Yep. I like to drive. One of the techniques that field biologists use to... I worked for many years for the Open Space District, who owns all the land around us, and what, as a biologist, and what I did was to discover... to locate rare and endangered species and species of special status, you know, for which the Open Space District can get money to buy and protect the land. All the land around Jikoji is a result of, you know, studies of a rare and endangered species that go on here. Tina says, this is a nice season to be here for those who love quiet and solitude more than wildflowers. It's not hot. She says, is the preserve really open 24 hours? Yep. So we can be here on hot summer nights in the air-conditioned cab when all the desert endemics are out. We bump along past a weathered, homemade gate. It doesn't look like it's been touched in decades. We enjoy the gradually emerging features of an abandoned farmstead as we approach. Little by little, it's letting go, the farmstead, settling back into the landscape, like what happens to me during long periods of zazen. The broad roof of a porch on the owner-built home rests in peace on the ground. Doors on a huge corrugated metal barn are now only openings in the sides for owls. All that remains of a once active farming community is an occasional bottle turned purple in the desert sun and trash. All the valuables are long gone. Fortunately, the site has been benevolently neglected by the U.S. Park Service, not cleaned up and sanitized. So occasional wanderers with an eye to history can enjoy a place like this. Do you know the word taphonomy? Taphonomy is the science of how the body of a dead animal scatters. But it also refers, in this instance, how a once thriving farmstead returns to what it was before it was made, just the desert. We pull up close to some great big metal water tanks. They are held together by a lot of big fat rivets, hand clinched by a forgotten blacksmith. This is an attractive spot, like a shade tree in the desert. I peer inside the tanks. There are piles of owl cough balls. You know, owls, when they eat something, they digest it and then they cough up the fur and bones. And we as biologists can look at the fur and bones, and every species of mammal and bird and reptile has a distinctive skull. So I can pick up an owl casting and break it open and see what kinds of animals are living there. And so one of the animals that I have never found in my long life as a biologist is Sorex miriami, which is a very, very rare shrew. And they live in desert places, and there are only five or six specimens known to science. And, you know, so when I'm looking at owl cough balls, I'm always thinking about finding one of these Sorex miriami skulls and collecting it. Tina hops down from the running board, stops, takes it all in without really needing to twirl her. What does that say? I should have brought reading glasses. Tina hops down from the running board, stops, takes it all in without really needing to twirl her eyeballs. Not a thing stirs in the immensity of the vista. In the distance is the Caliente Range. Oh. In an appropriately quiet voice, she says, "We're the only ones in the whole world, so we can pee wherever we want. It ain't like being in town. This preserve is 350,000 acres. It's bigger than the San Francisco Peninsula, and it's just us. Imagine that. I'm just enjoying her in her element. It's marvelous to see her listening with her 100 ears. She's obviously hearing something. Is it the voice of the desert? Have you heard it? It's also obvious that it's listening to her, and I'm not just playing with words. She says, it's so relaxing to be here. It's so perfect." When Coben married us in 1972, he asked me to write wedding vows. And I wrote some bullshit. And he wrote on it, on mine, my copy of the wedding vows, he wrote, "What?" And so Coben told me, I think one of the things that making a really good connection with a really good teacher. These are really good teachers here. They tell you things which you don't know. They tell you things about yourself. They tell you about, like, they give you something that straightens out your life. You know, like, for example, he said to me, and he wrote on my wedding vows, "Learn to relax." You know, as a young man, I guess I was not a very relaxed person, and I'd get, you know, when somebody would yell at me or, you know, something like that, you know, I'd get uptight, you know, and so. You know, this great koan that Coben gave me for my married life and for my life in general, you know, learn to relax. You know, you make a connection with a real teacher, and teacher will give you something that will straighten out your life. It's a very, very important thing to do. It's not just, you know, the ordination vows. You know, it's something that when you receive, you know, the ordination, the raksu here, it's. It's your protection. Softened by distance at the foot of purple mountain majesties, I can just make out that tiny gray island of boulders miles away. It stands all alone, on the other colored plane. It doesn't trumpet its presence. It's a natural temple. For thousands of years, Indians from more than one tribe came here in peace for worship, like they come to Jokoji Valley. This Carrizo Plain archaeological site is a when Coben first signed the deed for this for Jokoji here, and there was a big fight in our organization Bodhi, for some people wanted a city place and some people wanted a country place, and then this place was offered to us, and Coben just signed the deed. He didn't go to the to the board of directors. He just signed it, and then one day, soon after he did that, after Zazen, he came up next to me and he put his arm around my shoulder, and he said, he explained to me why he had taken that unusual step. He said, it will be good for your practice. So we have a place, a holy place here, which is good for our practice. And it's, at that time, Coben was spending quite a bit of time down in the Yucatan, and he, oh my God, have I been talking that long? Oh geez, better hurry. The Indians painted the inner walls of this grotto with the most extraordinary sacred paintings. To simply acknowledge that there are those who have found themselves in the presence of something sacred could be the first step for those who feel inclined. To merely designate these hieroglyphs as rock art, one dismisses their true significance. It is not an accurate or complete way to describe them. The word sacred is better because it can help us connect with something which is present in each of us, something that is primordial, which has been forgotten by many of us, but which is an ever-present help in times of need. Can I go on?
Mm-hmm.
It's time for a snack. We enjoy our food the same way my huge silverback gorilla friend Ndumi enjoys his. We like simple things, especially in places like this. I lay out cheese and crackers on the warm hood of the truck. Warm Jack cheese has a nice flavor and tenderness. I crack open a soda. It's all good. This picnic spot has a nice clean scentlessness. The air is warming up some. A white Pieris butterfly weaves between us and the tanks. What rapid wing beats it has. I hear from friends at the Nature Conservancy that this Carrizo Plains Preserve preserves the best of what remains of the once vast San Joaquin Plains ecosystem, so gloriously described by the first European and Chinese travelers. Almost all the rest not protected has gone under the plow, under water reclamation and irrigation projects, and in myriad roads and unchecked urbanization. Don't make the country into the city, Coben told us about this place when he signed the deed for this place. Don't turn the country into the city. Even since 1948, when Professor Bohart at UC Davis surveyed them, the magnificent cicada killer, one of the West's most interesting, most misunderstood, and least aggressive hornets, is on the verge of extinction in California. One time, Tina and I had a fat grant to search far and wide for the species in California. We managed to locate a few small colonies associated with large patches of asclepias, or milkweed, along a few of the older canals. At this moment, I am appreciating all the effort that went into establishing this wonderful preserve. Almost done. Being alone here is the key, the essential point. Taking a tour here is not sufficient. There is no need to be afraid of nature. Being alone and without another is vital, not being busy. From this spot, the seed of caring for our world, sprouts. I beg of you, please don't wait. I guess this is a good time to wrap it up with a love poem that I wrote for my wife. On that day. It's just a little thing, but I think it makes me cry sometimes when I think about it or when I'm feeling depressed and I need to feel her presence. Mi mujer tiene ojos grandes. My woman has great eyes. I think that when one of the things that I that I loved about Koban is that when you would have a private meeting with him, or when you just see him, you know, like, you know, we sat together every morning at Haiku Zendo, you know, and so I got a chance every morning to look into his eyes, you know, and he had great eyes too, you know, and when you look into his eyes, he was always right there with you. You know, it was like the most amazing thing. You could see eternity looking through his eyes. It's not a flirting kind of thing, you know, but it's something that's so magical, you know, to looking into a real Zen teacher's eyes. You know, it's forever manifests itself, you know, through a real teacher's eyes. You know it. You know, you look into Angie's eyes and you see that kind of thing. You know, you look into these guys' eyes here, you know, and they're, you know, you look in their eyes, you know, there's no wall. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I hope you enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.